Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the Occupy movement with Arun Gupta, who has been at 16 Occupy sites around the country and is the co-founder of the Occupy Wall Street Journal. He is covering the Occupy movement for Salon.com and Alternet, and we will discuss the impact of the movement so far and its future direction. Then we'll examine the Stop Online Piracy Act that is now being debated in Congress with Gigi Sohn, the co-founder of Public Knowledge, a Washington, D.C.-based public interest group working to defend citizens' rights in the emerging digital culture. We'll discuss the dangers posed by this bill to internet freedom, its embrace of censorship, and the extent to which it is a stealth attack on net neutrality. Then finally, we'll speak with the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, Paul Soglin, who joins us to discuss the recall now underway in Wisconsin to remove the divisive and polarizing governor, Scott Walker, who is personally feeling the heat as 1,000 protesters surrounded his home on Tuesday night, soliciting signatures for the recall petition. Joining us now is Arun Gupta, who is the founding editor of the New York City-based independent newspaper and a co-founder of the Occupy Wall Street Journal. He has been at over 16 of the Occupy sites around the country and is writing for Salon.com and Alternet. He's writing a book on the decline of the American empire. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arun Gupta.
Great to be with you.
And since the dust is settling somewhat on the eviction of Occupy Wall Street, obviously all of the punditry is, since day one, have always said, well, what's their agenda, what's their plan, etc. At the risk of sounding like the mainstream media, what is the next step?
Well, we've already seen the spread of Occupy movements, both internally and conceptually. So in New York City, there's Occupy Harlem, there's Occupy Brooklyn, Occupy Bushwick, all sorts of neighborhood occupations. Then you have a phenomenon like Occupy the campus, obviously university students. There's Occupy the boardroom, where people are bird-dogging the CEOs of Wall Street banks. Then you have Occupy the Hood, which is an African-American-led initiative. So this movement isn't going away, you know, but at the same time, yes, these attacks are a blow, and if we are to analyze it in a sober fashion, the movement, especially at the Zuccotti Park, should have been trying to develop a strategy for when this would happen. The only surprise is not that it happened, but that it took so long to happen. On the plus side, though, tomorrow, Thursday, there's going to be a very large protest, an attempt to nonviolently, peacefully shut down Wall Street, the New York Stock Exchange, itself through civil disobedience. So we'll see how that turns out. The movement will have to figure out what the next steps are, but every social movement that challenges the dominant order has to deal with state repression and violence, and this is no different. Once you start to threaten that order, they're going to come down on you with all the force that they have. So it needs to figure out how to circumvent, overcome, and basically get around this violence and repression.
And Arun Gupta, you have said that this is the revenge of the 1%. It's no coincidence that the largest occupations, Oakland, Portland, and New York, were all under attack at the same time. Well, we learn now that the mayor of Oakland revealed that she'd been in phone connection with 16 other mayors coordinating a response. So inadvertently, I guess, the Oakland mayor revealed this strategy on the part of the 1%.
Yeah, I think that's as close as a smoking gun as we're going to get. As opposed to the Occupy movement, which was completely about transparency, where you have the General Assemblies and these working groups, and it was live stream. Government and corporations are all about secrecy, secret wars, secret court proceedings, secretive intelligence gathering, and now we also see this coordinated attack was basically a secret meeting. And I think if they're claiming, oh no, that's not what we're talking about, well, they should release the full transcript.
Well, as you, I'm sure, are well aware, the continuing propaganda campaign against the Occupy movement continues. Newt Gingrich refers to it as European socialist class warfare. Fox News referred to Zuccotti Park, as Hannity did, as being overtaken by murderers and rapists. So there's no limit to which the propaganda is being leveled and disinformation is being leveled against the movement. What's your sense, though, of how it's faring in spite of the mainstream media of getting this message out to the broader sort of zeitgeist, if you will, the broader American public?
Well, I think it's really varied. It depends. I've been with my partner, Michelle Fawcett, to 16 separate occupations now. And in every city that we've been to, there's real solid support. But at the same time, often there's just people can be completely oblivious as to what's going on. I've interviewed bystanders who haven't even heard of Occupy Wall Street and have no idea what it's about. They just exist in their own bubble, probably a little consumptive bubble of shopping and television. But nonetheless, it still hasn't fully broken through that. And then, yes, a lot of people are basically eating, just consuming the propaganda fed to them by Fox News. At the same time, like I mentioned, there is generally a lot of support. It really varies from city to city. I think one of the problems of the movement is its popularity certainly outstripped its capacity. So by that I mean that it became wildly popular, but it had no way to engage with people, that it was the mediation was through the corporate media. And so there was a period where you had somewhat, you know, better than usual reporting about the Occupy movement. It still wasn't, I think, doing a good job journalistically, but certain narratives reasserted themselves, like the allegations of violence in Oakland, and the media reverted back to the forum, in which they're more interested in reporting on broken windows than broken lives. So really, I think one of the challenges ahead is how to systematically engage the public in a way where they don't need the corporate media, where it can be shunted aside. And that's not a simple, there's no simple solution to that.
I'm afraid your phone is sort of going in and out. I don't know whether it's the connection, but Arun Gupta, again, the founding editor of the New York City-based Independent, he also helped found the Occupy Wall Street Journal. And
right now I'm reporting for Salon and Alternet on the Occupy movement nationwide.
Well, I'm glad we included that. Now, you mentioned a little while ago that you thought that the Zuccotti Park occupiers perhaps should have strategized in advance of what would be an inevitable takedown in spite of Mayor Bloomberg's credentials amongst liberals as being a decent guy. I spoke yesterday with the Reverend Billy, who months ago in an interview before any of this began, told me that he thought that Bloomberg had a real hostility to the First Amendment. I think that was certainly borne out by yesterday's activities. But nevertheless, could you expand on what you think strategy should be and what the next steps might be?
Well, it's not really for me. I mean, I've been to many occupations. I was at Zuccotti Park for the first 3 weeks of the occupation there. You know, I think this is such a dynamic and diverse movement that hopefully they will figure it out. There are a lot of great organizers who are at these various occupations, especially in the big city occupations like New York, Philadelphia, Chicago. You know, one of the things is certainly these type of creative actions that we've seen. Just a few days ago was this action in Hawaii where this singer unveiled a T-shirt. His was at a dinner of Asia Pacific Economic Cooperation or so council, and he unveiled a T-shirt that said "Occupy with Honolulu," and then sang a pro-Occupy song to President Obama and all these other dignitaries. And that was actually, it wasn't just him. There was the Yes Men were involved with that, and some other people who I know were involved with making that happen. And so one of the great things about this is it's really getting into the face of the 1%. that this is a movement that's kind of disrupted a lot of social and cultural norms, where there are areas of culture, you know, you see this in intruding into fashion, into food, things that we do, into music, certainly things that are supposedly or we thought were depoliticized are becoming politicized because of the Occupy movement. At the same time, I think the occupations are absolutely critical to this movement because and to our society at large, because what it revealed was the absolute absence of any sort of democratic public forum where people individually and collectively were able to not just express themselves, but to be able to organize around important issues in their community and the larger society. And that's why the 1% is smashing these occupations. You know, let's be clear. I mean, Bloomberg is like, you know, that he's not just the top 1%. He's literally probably one of the, you know, 20 or 30 richest people in the world. He's worth something like $20 billion. So he's like the top 1% of 1% of 1%. And then a lot of these big city mayors also, these are wealthy people, or they're going to be wealthy people because they, you know, stroke these connections that they get by being in power, returning favors to corporations and the wealthy in return for campaign contributions. The U.S. Senate, two-thirds of them are millionaires, and on average they're multimillionaires. In the House of Representatives, over 40% of them are millionaires. These are all 1%. So none of it should surprise us that, you know, you have the 1% in the executive boardrooms, the 1% in the political chambers, the 1% in the corporate media, who are all attacking this movement in concert.
Well, Arun Gupta, you mentioned the 1% in the Congress. 60 Minutes did a recent piece on how the Congress have exempted themselves from insider trading laws, and they've been taking advantage of being able to trade on proprietary information that only people in the Congress have and all make money. So little wonder they're a part of the 1%. But I have a feeling that that kind of information is really riling up people. And I'm just wondering if there's a political direction for all of this anger. You have the anger on the right with the Tea Party that in part has been captured by the oligarchs, by the Kochs and their operatives like Dick Armey and Karl Rove. What do you think is the possibility of channeling this energy and anger politically? Obviously, there's a real problem here. Nobody wants to vote for these whores and hirelings of the 1%.
That's a good way to put it. And you know, this movement, the Occupy movement, it's the occupations that brought the movement to life. But there was already a massive amount of despair, of anger, and there was also a lot of important organizing, political organizing that was going on. But it was the occupations of public space that brought the movement into being. And part of the reason it was so successful is because it has shunned electoral politics. So I don't think it's wise for it to enter electoral politics, because the Democrats are as much part of the problem as Republicans.
There's also, of course, as much as people are disappointed in Obama and as much as he's continued the policies of the 1%, the other side, of course, really want to cement the oligarchy in a way that would make it permanent. So I'm not sure what the answer is here, because if you abdicate from the political system altogether, then the bad guys win hands down.
Yeah, that's completely true. You know, I think getting money out of politics would be a positive start. You know, returning things like the fairness doctrine, having guaranteed airtime on television would take a lot of the money out of politics, like a lot of countries do. If candidates get 5 or 10% of the vote in polls, they get guaranteed airtime on the public airwaves. You know, let's remember who owns these airwaves. So we can talk a lot of ideas about this, but it's still there are much more fundamental issues about what type of society we want to live in, what would work look like, what would community, family look like, you know, what are the needs and rights of people that we want to not just enshrine in theory, but make actual in practice. And we're not going to do any of that by going through trying to change the political system from within. You know, at the same time, I'm not saying, you know, ignore it. It's always an inside-outside strategy. But if history is a guide, it's the movements that do come from the outside in creative, disruptive ways, like the labor movement of the 1930s, the civil rights movement, the anti-war feminist movement of the 60s and 70s, that really help to restructure society in a much more positive fashion. And Occupy Wall Street has that potential today if it continues to develop and mature.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Arun Gupta.
Sure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Arun Gupta, who's the founding editor of the New York-based independent newspaper and a co-founder of the Occupy Wall Street Journal. And he's writing a book on the decline of the American empire and has been at over 16 of the Occupy sites around the country and is writing for Salon.com and Alternet. Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment talking about how the Congress is trying again in a stealth way to undo net neutrality. Some of the feds got us, some of us dead, a lot of us still solid though, using all the lips the streets taught us, and what that heat cost us, and what that loss gave us. With the people, it's always gonna come back around, it's about to be big movements from below, the golden age lies ahead, struggles proceed, you can't lie to yourself, you can't lie how it felt, no surprise how to come.